tellers and prophets. The medium and its chance of speaking for us all had raised movies to a rare opportunity and responsibility. America was in an age of war, assassinations, racial ferment, and a sexual adventure. It was having a bad time, but a great time on the same hectic screen. So that's a passage from David Thompson's A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors. David Thompson has many irritating tics, such as the use of you, of revising a given movie for the director, an outlandish and sometimes salacious set of ideas, but it makes a good companion piece to Peter Conrad's book, and they could be read in tandem. But this is just a brief mention. Jeff and I will be discussing the book in more detail in a few weeks. Thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screen.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hey, it's Kanan, and you're listening to Pacific Underground. This month, we talked to renowned Asian-American author Jeff Chang, who is known for his insightful and seminal work on race, hip-hop, and the lesser-known roots of American culture. He just dropped a new book this month called We Gon' Be Alright, Notes on Race and Resegregation. Co-producer Pam Santos and I were lucky enough to catch him while he was hustling to one of what could only be a ton of speaking engagements. Earlier this month, we aired the abridged membership drive version of this interview on our home station, KBOO, in Portland. But now we're bringing you the whole damn thing. So I'm going to get out of the way and let's get to the interview.
So your book, We Gon' Be Alright, Notes on Race and Resegregation, you titled one of your chapters, The In-Betweens. We definitely wanted to hear from you about how that in-betweenness applies to Asian American identity, just being caught up between whiteness and blackness.
Yeah, I think, you know, I first of all, the book is sort of in some ways like a thank you note to the Movement for Black Lives for raising these questions, putting them front and center back into the national discourse and consciousness, and being just being about it, right? Just being unapologetic, being powerful and forceful and inclusive and visionary and expansive about it, and for offering us ways to rethink race and racial justice, you know, in the U.S., especially in this particular moment. So I couldn't do that without actually addressing my particular place as somebody who comes from Chinese and Native Hawaiian descent, right? So the essay came from that. It was, in part a response to my editor saying, there's not enough you in here. And I'm like, I have a very hard time. I've always had a very hard time writing in first person. And even in this essay, it's written in second person. But it, I think, allowed me to be able to be a little bit more explorative of the ambivalences and the sort of privileges that come with being in between, right? So being able to look at both the, you know, oppression side of it as well as questions of anti-blackness, and to really understand that the in-betweens are about being able to have the privilege to not take a stand, to sit on the fence, to disengage, to step away from the battle, to wait to see how it all shakes out and then choose a side. And that's the essence, I think, of privilege. And to be able to do that at the same time while recognizing that, you know, our histories come from exclusion, of overcoming, you know, discrimination and struggle, you know, and what does that mean? How does that change us? How does it traumatize people in different kinds of ways? How does it justify really, really bad politics and thinking, as well as very powerful laboratory, you know, types of thinking as well? And so I try to get inside the in-between, so to speak, in the essay. And to use kind of, you know, a bit of my own story as an entry point to be able to get into talking about all of these types of questions.
I was really taken by that chapter in particular because it was a huge departure from the rest of the book. And it was like really real. It was really vulnerable. It seems like you really like put yourself out there. And in addition to the in-betweenness as it applies to like Asian Americanness somewhere along that spectrum of white supremacy and black liberation, is like your personal in-betweenness in your story as an Asian American trying to negotiate these issues. Can you talk a little bit more about your experience as you move through these issues, as you kind of try to digest them and place yourself within them?
Sure. Yeah, it was a really, really difficult, you know, essay to write, and I think it's still even hard to kind of talk about it in some ways. I've never really wanted to make myself the center of this, because it's not a really, I don't really think it's about that in the end. You asked, so I guess I have to answer. I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I grew up pretty staunchly middle class, you know, working class on my mom's side, working class on my dad's side, that then comes into money, it's like kind of strikes it big in some ways. Not that big, but big enough that we can move to a suburb of Honolulu. I spent, you know, my childhood basically kind of in between the, you know, the town and the country. My grandparents are on the countryside, on the windward side of Oahu, and between this sort of, I wouldn't say, you know, impoverished, but definitely like not necessarily high income or middle income type of neighborhood. And I went to a private school, although I was a scholarship kid. So I was kind of in between in all these different kinds of ways. You know, as a scholarship kid, I had to serve my peers lunch. So that kind of marked me class-wise within the school. And you know, and that, I think, gave me sort of a formative class consciousness. And these are all the kinds of things that sort of come to bear later on, because I moved to California to go to school. And suddenly, for the first time, I'm confronting the fact that, you know, on the continent, I'm really a minority. It's really stark. You know, there's a lot of stuff that happens, mundane microaggressions to near violence, and also seeing it happen to a lot of friends that I was making too, and trying to reconcile that during a period when, you know, trying to figure out your identity is core to who you are anyways, right, at that particular point in life, early adulthood, late teenagehood, whatever. And so, you know, that all comes to bear in there, along with this sort of political awakening, because we were coming of age during the culture wars, and Asian Americans were playing a very specific role at that particular point in the culture wars, kind of being batted around, used as a tool by conservative folks to oppose affirmative action, at the same time that a lot of folks were pushing for racial justice, you know, in a very kind of explicit way, in solidarity with communities of color and feminists and queer folks as well. So all of that kind of figured in to my coming of age, and I think that's the period that I tried to revisit as I was thinking about these kinds of questions, because they kind of indelibly marked me. They contributed to my sense of who I am today and how I need to be as a parent now moving forward with kids.
It was actually great that you didn't start out with that chapter, because I think the earlier chapters laid the groundwork. You're putting the background and the context in when you're talking about college spaces and also the ways that cities have changed. And I think most importantly for me, before I would get to that part where you had the children's rhyme that I'm going to say, even though I kind of I hate it in my mouth saying it. So
I hear you.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Ching Chong Chinaman sitting on a fence trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. And as Kanan here knows that I talk about Queens all the time, and just thinking about that in rap music, like, I know that line. But you were able to talk about class in this too.
Yeah,
along with race.
It's a serious part of it. And, you know, a lot of the ways in which the data and the image of Asian Americans is these tiger families and tiger clans with, like, the super achieving, you know, kids. You know, a lot of the ways that gets twisted as a deliberate way to kind of obscure questions of class in the Asian American community. In California, for instance, there's been a big debate about disaggregating, you know, Asian American ethnic data. And in some respects, that still only gets to part of the question, because we haven't looked at stratification in the Asian American community as deeply as we could. And certainly the folks who have, their work isn't publicized all as much. And at the same time, there's this small, very vocal minority of conservative Asian Americans who have captured the media's imagination, you know, around the Peter Leung case, and then now around segregation of data and questions of affirmative action and that kind of thing. I mean, the data all shows that we're a very, you know, diverse community, income-wise, wealth-wise, that the foreclosure crisis impacted Asians dramatically. You know, wealth dropped by over half in those years of the foreclosure crisis, hasn't necessarily been recovered since then. And the data also shows that Asian Americans are overwhelmingly for racial justice. Two-thirds favor affirmative action, large majorities and pluralities favor any number of bills that would be considered, ideas that would be considered liberal. And yet the media thinks that we're this grand mystery, that there's this, that there are these huge debates. You know, they play up, I think, this very vocal minority of conservative Asian Americans who do exist. I don't doubt that they are trying to organize. I know it, I see it, I write about it in this particular chapter. I describe my feelings of ambivalence about it, you know, but they're still a very small minority of folks. They're not gaining ground. So you know, the question started as one about class, and it kind of branched out. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we do definitely need more light shed on the question of class stratification in the Asian American community. It would give us a much better picture and understanding of why it is that so many Asian Americans support racial justice measures.
I wanted to bring up Grace Lee Boggs, because
sure.
you mentioned her at some like really important points in your writing, and I think she's a really notable person because her philosophy, her ethics, her just approach to racial and social justice is so human. It centers around empathy and like humanizing everyone. But, you know, she didn't work directly with any sort of Asian American, Pacific Islander social justice movements. She was working to help solidify and increase Black power in the United States. So can you talk about like how it's so difficult to find a mouthpiece for the API community that really encompasses such like a pan-ethnic made up group's feelings and experiences?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we're still kind of in formation, so to speak, right, around these kinds of questions. You know, part of the difficulty of that is just what might be described of as the nature of Asian American identity, right? We're still in the process of trying to figure out what that is. And this is a population, of course, that has moved from being overwhelmingly U.S. born, you know, when the Third World Strike breaks out in 1968, for instance, and the rise of the Asian American movement that Karen Ishizuka writes about so wonderfully in this new, you know, history, sort of the people, to now, where it's, you know, a majority foreign-born population, where immigration laws have changed dramatically in the last two decades, especially to emphasize skilled labor over family reunification. And in that regard, you know, created a much more homogenous looking, not necessarily ethnically, but sort of class-wise, immigrant population. And so, you know, it's very complicated. It's really complicated. What happens when you've got a large number of Asian Americans who don't consider themselves Asian American? Like, they're mobile, right? They live between here and Taipei, you know, or between here and Seoul, or between here and Hong Kong, between here and Mumbai. You know, it's, and you can just go on and on and on in that regard. It's we're still kind of information, I think, in that regard. What we see is sort of the beginnings of this flowering of Asian American culture in the public sort of middle American, you know, sort of mainstream. You know, we're at the very beginnings of that. And we've certainly had our thinkers and our writers. But, you know, the first sentence of this essay is, you went to college to learn how to be Asian American. It's something that is still being created. It's still sort of an idea that we are toying with and trying to build of all these different, sometimes disparate, sometimes dissonant parts.
I'm really glad you made those two references to formation. I got really into Beyonce. Anyway, I brought it up because I just thought all of the different references that you bring in from culture were so spot on. Like, first, even the title, Kendrick Lamar, the We Gonna Be All Right. But then your conclusion is titled Making Lemonade.
Yes.
And a lot of what I think I took from it is lessons that I think can apply really to anybody reading your book, whether they are in communities of color, API or not. I think a large part of it had to do with using culture as a way to bring people in on these harder political concepts. Mm-hmm. And even though it's all the way at the end.
It felt like a gift. Like, I was at the end of writing this really fast book, and then Lemonade dropped, and I'm like, whoa. You know, it kind of time stood still for a couple of weeks, I think. And the deadline kind of got pushed out a little bit. But I felt like it summed up so many of the sort of ideas that have been floating, you know, in the air since Ferguson, right? And questions and ideas that have been raised by the movement for Black Lives, and in particular, this notion of transformational justice. And so, you know, on the first reading, this is like an album that's about about a lover who's being cheated on, and all the emotions that she ended up going through, and the sort of anger, the despair, the depression, and then this sort of trying to find a sense of grace in it all and reconciling. And I was like, dang, you know what? She obviously wants to read this in light of what's been happening in the world. I mean, freedom is the most explicit note of that. But as well, I thought maybe this is kind of about like the moment that we're in socially, you know, maybe this is about the direction of the movement. And sure enough, the ending feels so convergent with Grace Lee Boggs' ideas, with Robin Kelly's reading of James Baldwin as being about the politics of love, and not like this sappy milquetoast turn the other cheek type of vibe, although I think that there's a lot of spirituality in that. Not mocking, you know, the sort of notion of that either. And also Carrie Mae Weems is most recent work, thinking about grace and dignity in the face of ongoing struggle. And I was like, dang, this is all of it. It's all there. It's everything. It's too good not to be written about. So that's kind of where I wanted to end it. And it ends on a note of hope, right? Like, we do have to have a reason to be able to get up in the morning. We do have to, with all our criticality and all of our anger, be able to figure out what is the way forward, you know. When that anger starts turning to depression and we realize the depth of trauma that's set in, like, how do you undo that? How do you heal? And how do you heal not just yourself, but how do you heal the community and who is considered part of that community? And so, you know, you go back to Grace's idea that revolution is not only about bloodshed. It's not about warfare. It's not replacing one group of oppressors with another. It's about transformation. That's where we need to end up at the end of the day. So it's about consciousness, human consciousness, raising that human consciousness. And so that's kind of where we ended up with it all.
Can you talk about the perception that like extends, I think, beyond the white community, that is kind of condescending and paints students as naive, reckless, soliciting pity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, I think the one of the central kind of paradoxes of the moment is the fact that in our media, sort of in the mainstream, in our institutions, we're sort of painted this picture of diversity, right? The sort of notion that we all kind of live in this happy rainbow nation, and that we attend perfectly integrated schools, and that everything is awesome, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, you know, all of the indices show that we're resegregating, that inequality is increasing between the races at a very dramatic rate, has been for decades. We reached peak desegregation in the schools in 1989. And since that time, we've been moving backwards. And so for me, student protests have really been about that. Like, can you imagine a place in society that traffics more thoroughly in images of diversity than university institutions, who often themselves are not that diverse? And you have schools that are 95% white that will work very hard to find students of color on campus and take pictures of them and put them in their brochures, on their websites, right, in their application packets, all of the materials to signal to, you know, parents and to students the vitality of their institution, right? The sort of progressiveness of their institution. Nancy Leong, who's a brilliant scholar, has a term for this. She calls it racial capitalism, that people and institutions get capital from being able to draw on images of diversity, the picture of diversity, right? And so what students are calling into question from Missouri on to over 100 other campuses was the gap between the picture of diversity and the reality of what's been happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. That's been the real issue. The debate has been sidetracked into all of these weird questions about trigger warnings and about safe spaces and such. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at the actual demands, and they're on the web, right? There's a website called thedemands.org, and people have done analyses of these. Like, precious few students at precious few campuses were pushing for any kind of change in the speech codes. The overwhelming majority of student activists were demanding that there be more faculty of color, that they were demanding that there be more staff of color, that there be more culturally sensitive programming and classes and curriculum and departments, and that there be mental health professionals of color. And that's because since the last peak of universities paying attention to this, which is around the early 90s when the term campus climate became very popular and widely used, for the most part, a lot of these programs have either been cut back drastically or have been stalled in terms of size and growth, even as their populations have sometimes been exploding. That's what students are trying to call attention to, was that particular, you know, that particular paradox, that particular tension that's happening on the campuses, but is literally a microcosm of what's happening in society more in general.
So would you say diversity in this incarnation, as we're seeing it everywhere in all these institutions, is like a form of complacency? I know you talk a lot about crisis cycles, and it seems like the uproar on college campuses we've seen in the past year and a half is like a disruption of that complacency, but it still seems like there's a pretty widespread complacency in reaction to these protests.
Yeah, I think that there's a backlash as well, and I think that the backlash is happening amongst liberals, amongst white liberals, as well as amongst conservatives. There's, you know, very sort of strange bedfellows being made right now between the sort of freedom of expression libertarians and sort of the anti-multiculturalist liberals, that is repeating what happened, I think, in the 80s and the 90s. And so we're going through a period of culture wars around these questions of demographic change and cultural change. And those are the cycles that I try to describe. These are cycles that are actually happening, as opposed to cycles that we imagine, you know, should be happening, based on, you know, whatever readings of the past. I don't try to read the future. I try to read the past,
right,
to what's happening, to what's happening right now. And the reality is that diversity becomes decoupled from equity. And in the decoupling, we are able to see how folks can sort of capitalize on the picture of diversity while, you know, while simultaneously letting the question of equity fall to the side.
And so you're talking about like not claiming to be able to look into the future, which I feel like is super valid. And it's something that I needed to hear because like I'm tempted, you know, because you've just released this book, like, what do you think is going to happen is like the question that
the pundits
on the media are asked, you know?
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I know that like what we need to do is to try to figure out ways to find our connections and to think about, you know, the convergences. I've been really heartened to see, you know, folks joining in solidarity, you know, with Standing Rock Sioux, folks, you know, the No Doubt stuff. And, mm-hmm. And also, you know, to be able to see like what's happening between the undocumented movement and the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, we're about to launch Culture Strike, is about this organization that I have to co-found, is about to launch an initiative called Until We All Are Free, in which we try to look at the question of what it means to be invisibilized as a Black undocumented person, and to also have other non-Black migrant and immigrant communities question and interrogate and undo their anti-Blackness. You know, so there's all of these different kinds of things that are happening. Certainly there have been all kinds of consonances between, you know, the movement around sexual assault on the campuses to combat sexual assault and end sexual assault, as well as the movements to, you know, sort of undo racism. And I think that those kinds of things are happening organically. What needs to happen is for folks to be able to now figure out how to bring in disaffected white folks, mm-hmm. The sort of declining middle class, the rapidly declining middle class, as well as the working class and the completely alienated white underclass as well. Those are the folks who may need to travel far in some respects around the question of race, but who are, you know, are in some ways, you know, natural accomplices in trying to figure out, you know, how we move all of this stuff forward.
I was going to point out that I think you talk about Obama, his being elected nearly 8 years ago, and how people were kind of looking to that as like hope for the future. But I don't know. In reality, like you talk about political change as a reflection of change that has already happened in society, in our psyches. And so the stage was already set for Obama to be elected. And we were kind of looking to him to help correct these issues. But in reality, a lot of these issues don't emerge from the top and trickle down. It seems like they start at the grassroots level. So I guess like with the solidarity we're seeing at Standing Rock, the movement for Black Lives, API activists engaged in both of those and in so many other social issues, like how do you hope these grassroots movements are going to, I guess, bear fruit and manifest themselves politically?
You know, well, it's, you know, like we were saying earlier, it's hard to predict. But what, you know, what I hope is out of this emerges sort of an organic, you know, grassroots up kind of vision for being able to explore change and the transformation of society. And so things like the Movement for Black Lives platform are really amazing types of moments. Here's a document now that outlines what liberation can really look like. And Alicia Garza, of course, has written that when Black people get free, everybody gets free. The Movement for Black Lives platform is a perfect example of how that can be, right? Mm-hmm. All of the things that are being asked for are things that would free all of us, And so for that to be central and that for that to be a building block to which other people can add things that complete the sort of picture is something that I think builds a potentially powerful movement. And I don't want to predetermine, or I don't even want to predict like how that could look like. That's not like what I'm best at or what my job is, but that's what I live in hope of, really. You know, that we'll be able to figure it out, that we'll be able to get it all right.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you know, like while we're working towards these changes and kind of waiting for them to manifest, one of the helpful and heartening ways of overcoming the daily oppression that so many people experience is documentation. And you talked about like the microaggressions project and,
yes,
you know, sharing stories, supporting one another. Can you talk a little bit about like where else we're seeing this and like what kind of power that has?
You know, so I think that, well, the first thing to say is that this is a really fertile period for all kinds of expression, I think, because of the inspiration of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's created the ground for artists and for, you know, journalists and for thinkers to really enter the question of what it means to live, what it means to live together. And so it's been really heartening to be able to see, gosh, all of this great music coming out, all of this great contemporary art being made, all of these amazing theatrical pieces and performances being done. And then also to read the writings of people who are, you know, moving, you know, on the ground, these movements, and to explore the sort of, you know, joy that comes when people are starting to figure things out together. All of this stuff is really, really key. I've been, I think, you know, really inspired by the letter writing movement that Asian Americans have picked up in writing letters to their parents, having conversations with their parents around Black Lives Matter. And I've been really inspired by just the work that folks are being able to do across these creative sectors, because what I think it does is it begins to build our imagination for what change can actually look like. That to me is the fundamental thing, you know, before we can even get to the change, we have to bring into being these visions and ideas and notions that, you know, allow us to think that what was impossible can be possible. We're in that moment right now. It's really, really exciting.
The music means it's the end of our show this month. Hope you enjoyed the interview. Pacific Underground is Jenna Yokoyama, Pamela Santos, Tabitha Teo, and me, Kanan Schlesinger. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground. You can also subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. Special thanks to Jeff Chang for making the time to speak with us, and to Chops, Winton White, and Jason Chu for the music. Pacific Underground is a production of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Big thanks to them for the studio space, support, and love. Thanks y'all for listening. We'll be back next month. In the meantime, check out Weekly Disruption, a short production where we embarrass ourselves by giving hot takes on a week's worth of headlines concerning but rarely brought to us by API folk. Thanks again. See you next time.
In Berkeley, a new kind of radio station was born.
Brotherhood.
In the community.
Freedom and justice.
On the air, Berkeley Boo, a popular marijuana strain, gave Boo the call name.
Failure of government.
Was and is the truth.
Truth as we see it.
A basement in Old Town was donated. For less than $4,000, an important force on Portland's airwaves was born.
Action against injustice
is what we stand for, and we fuel the fire together, and KBOO's listeners is why community radio in Portland thrives.
Powerful and just
is how I describe KBOO, and together we make the grass greener. Thank you, Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Calhoun. Thank you, Gray.
Love.
Thank you, KBOO. Please go to kboo.fm/giveaway to support KBOO right now.
Show your support for KBOO today by becoming a member. Just text KBOO to the phone number 44321 and join the thousands of members who make volunteer-powered radio possible.
man. It's hot. It's sweet. It's delicious. It's KBOO, my friends. That's right. You might have heard about a few of your friends and neighbors who jumped in, make sure that they had done their part to keep KBOO fierce, free, and independent. You know, our friends Matthew, Sally, Tom, and Marianne. An anonymous friend has also joined the fray. Now, some of these folks who have been contributing over the last few weeks are fortunate in that they have access to, well, extra resources, and they can put in a little more to help cover folks for whom it's more difficult and would be a greater pinch. It's a beautiful thing, and you can do it too. If you thought, well, you know, I can't really give as much as I'd want to. Well, don't worry about it. Give as much as you can. If that's not feasible for you, don't worry about it. Other folks are picking up your slack. That's what we're doing. This is collective action for the benefit of all. Right? Each acting for the benefit of all. Everyone puts in what they can so that everyone gets what they need. That's what this is about. And that's what you're about. That's why you're listening. Just like these hot swinging cats behind me, each is putting in what makes the sounds that make sense for them, the sounds that they can do. You can be a part of that. You joined us long ago with your ears. Then you joined us with your heart, your mind, and your soul. Now, I'm calling out to everyone who has room in their pocketbook to join us that way as well. KBOO.FM/GIVE. KBOO.FM/give. That will bring you to a safe, convenient, easy, and secure web form that you can fill out. Use a credit card. Tell your bank or credit union, financial institution of your choice, to give KBOO a certain amount each month on your behalf. However you do it, you just do it. At the level and in the manner that makes sense for you. This is how we support each other. This is how you can support the community resource that helps you support your community. KBOO.FM/GIVE. Not everyone is adept at navigating the internet or even has reliable access to it. For folks in that category, or for folks not in that category, who in solidarity with folks in that category, if that's your thing, you can mail your contribution to KBOO. The physical address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. know there's some curious folks want to know what's going on there. What is that? What who are these swinging cats behind me? Tohu Aizawa Quartet. Track is called Sacrament. This is just a little bit of all the kinds of the wide range of the tastiness you find here, which is one tiny part of why you keep tuning in and why it's important to you that this little space on the FM dial remains free and open to this kind of expression. A lot of your friends and neighbors agree. A lot of folks who don't even like this stuff support the fact that this channel is here to provide it. Ooh. Ikermoso Mulatu. This is the Pete Zandia remix. Oh, so tasty. Please invest what you can in the way that you can. I would like to stress that you can do that at kboo.fm/give. You can also text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Again, the number is 44321, and you are sending the message KBOO to that number. Mailing address is 20. That's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. There is no Serbian house. There is no Serbian house. What there is solidarity, though. So thank you to Matthew, Bruce, Tom, Sally, Marianne, and our anonymous friend. Will you be joining that list? That'd be cool. Ooh, I'm your terrestrial angel, keeping you connected here. Slamantha Fox. It's been a while since I've been able to join y'all and bring you a full musical program. I'm privileged and honored and quite pleased. To join you here in this midday section to remind you of what it takes to keep this kind of thing available to everyone. And to ask you to do what you can to be part of that process, to be part of what keeps KBOO free, what keeps KBOO independent and fierce and able to bring you what it is you need. To connect you with your community. The Portland community, the Cascadia community, the West Coast community. Yeah, we're keeping you up to date on Southern California. With programs from our comrades at KPFK in Los Angeles. With KPFA in Berkeley, keeping us in touch with the San Francisco Bay Area. KPFT in Houston brings us Arab Voices. WBAI, WFMU, I think it is. WORT. We are very fortunate to have many comrades across the nation and around the world sharing the kind of programming with us that they make for their communities. Sometimes it's directly relevant to what's going on here in Cascadia. Sometimes it's just dispatches of that are specific to that to their area. It's still good to know. It's useful. It's important. And you recognize that. That's why you listen. That's why so many of you invest your available resources to keep this available, not just for yourselves, but for your whole community. Collective action. Each contributing to the benefit of all. KBOO.FM/GIV. 44321. Use that in your messenger app to text KBOO. I believe from there it will ask you how much. There's so many things that we use and for which we must pay or we lose access to it. KBOO's a little different. Your KBOO bill is entirely up to you. Will you pay? How much will you pay? How often will you pay? All those questions are left entirely up to you. So, answer that question now. For folks who answer, yes, I will pay. How much? That's up to you.
And I would like to stress. There is no service in house.
I will continue to stress that the reason to get involved, that's up to you. I can tell you, I can go on and on about all the things going on here, all the programming and the things that go into the efforts and resources that go into producing all this programming. And that's reasons that KBOO needs your support. But the reason that you will provide that support, that's up to you. What are your reasons for supporting KBOO? Hopefully they match pretty closely. They line up, they kind of parallel with your reasons for tuning in. Because if you're not supporting it, if no one supports it, there's nothing to tune in for. So far, we've all been very, very lucky that there have always been sufficient, about 8 to 12% of the people listening at any given time are actively supporting KBOO. And you hear what we can do with that. What if we had 15 or 20%? Well, that would take some new members to joining the KBOO Foundation. Will that be you? It can, at kboo.fm/GIVE. Text KBOO to 44321. Again, 44321 is the number to which you are texting KBOO. Send your financial support via the post office and we'll eventually get it to 20. That's 20. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'm heading out in a minute. Gonna leave you with FKJ and Masego to bring you to the top of the hour. And Jeff Rosenberg's gonna take you from noon to 3. With a special program honoring the oeuvre of Robert Zimmerman.
That thing so beautiful.
Da-da.
She just hit my heart, oh.
Da-da.
Full force, and she got me like.
Da-da.
I be like,
da-da.
Baby,
da-da.
Why you so fine?
Gotta make you mine.
So hard to find.
Da-da.
listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
This is KBOO Portland. Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Rosenberg. I usually host the program in the time slot after this one, the Song Circle, that starts usually at 1:30 p.m. But I want to thank Lori Sonnefeld for generously giving up her monthly time slot here that's usually moving on so that I can bring you all a three-hour special celebrating Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, which is coming up on Monday. We've been able to celebrate Bob's birthday a few times over the years with specials during the membership drive, and it's great to have the opportunity to bring you this special as part of our membership drive, which is coming to a close tomorrow. So if you have yet to contribute to KBOO Community Radio, now